You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For the past year and a half, COVID has upended study abroad for college students. And this year, many students in Wisconsin are hoping to get their second and last chance to spend a semester in another country before graduation. But Rich Kramer reports there's still lingering uncertainty due to the pandemic. We're going to switch gears here now to the uptick in plastic and reconstructive surgery in these times. According to a survey earlier this year from the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, the first wave of pandemic-related pent-up demand saw a rush on facial procedures in response to a significant surge in Zoom calls and downtime for discreet recovery at home. Have you or a loved one had cosmetic or reconstructive surgery? What were the circumstances and decisions around the procedure? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Ahmed Afifi is an associate professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's president-elect of the Wisconsin Society of Plastic Surgeons. Dr. Afifi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me on your show.
Good morning. Start with some broad stroke observations, if you would. What are you seeing in capacity and in trends and procedures in these pandemic times?
Absolutely. So this was sort of unexpected. We didn't think that the pandemic would lead to this hugely increased demand on plastic surgery. So when the pandemic started, we obviously all shut down our offices for safety reasons and to save masks and to help with our ICU colleagues. But then once we opened up, the demand was much more than usual. At first, we thought it is just a backlog of patients who were canceled during the early phase of the pandemic, but this has persisted now for the last 14 months. Mm-hmm. And I think there are several possible reasons for that. Like you mentioned, one of them is being able to work from home. So patients can now have major surgery, and then going back to work basically means going to a dinner table and opening their laptop and logging back to work. So they can be back to work in probably 2 or 3 days in a rather more comfortable setting. The other thing is the Zoom, that everyone is working on Zoom right now and everything is online. So that small picture that we all see of ourselves in the top right corner, mm-hmm. people are looking at that picture and saying, wow, I'm seeing more lines. And men are saying, I have more hair loss than what I thought. And this is something that patients have always told us from even before the Zoom thing, is that they would say, I look at the mirror and I see a different person than what I feel. I feel much younger. I feel much more energized than the person I see in the mirror. And I just want to look as good as I feel.
You know, we've talked with some professions, like yesterday, a veterinarian-oncologist who said staffing is really difficult in our profession. The turnover in vets and vet techs is a huge problem. Is your specialty facing a staffing crunch?
I think it is the same across all specialties. I think plastic surgeons in general, the surgeons themselves, we have a very happy profession. We all love what we do, and no one is leaving plastic surgery. Yes, finding staff and nurses can be hard. There's a lot of turnover. There's a lot of demand across all aspects of healthcare, I think, right now.
Yeah. Do you find that insurance covers your patient's surgery, or are your patients mainly paying completely out of pocket?
That's a great question. I'm so glad you asked that question. So a large part of what we do are out of pocket, like cosmetic patients, they're paying out of pocket and their insurance doesn't cover it. However, there are many things that we call functional plastic surgery. There are many procedures that many patients can have insurance cover them, and patients just do not know that insurance covered them. The easiest example, because this just happened to me this week, are people who have droopiness of their eyebrows or their eyelids over time, and is starting to obstruct their visual field. They cannot see anymore. They have to, with their hands, lift their eyebrows so that they can have full field of vision. And this is something that insurance covers and has always covered. And many patients are not aware of that. There are so many other examples I can give you. People who have headaches, people who cannot breathe through their nose, people who have large breasts causing back pain, many other examples of things that can be covered by insurance, and many patients are not aware of that.
And what about like cancer patients who have a mastectomy? Would that be something that might be covered?
Absolutely. That's actually a large part of my practice. And this was a law that a federal law that was passed in the 90s that mandates that with any breast cancer surgery, the insurance has to cover reconstruction.
Yeah. What about things like scar removal or skin lacerations? Would that be considered reconstructive in nature that insurers might be willing to cover?
Yes, absolutely. So the line between reconstructive and cosmetic is not a very sharp line.
Mm-hmm.
So I do lots of reconstructive surgery. I tell patients I do everything with a cosmetic background, with a cosmetic mindset. So yes, improving the appearance of scars, whether by surgery or by lasers, is something that many insurances would cover.
We're talking with Dr. Ahmed Afifi, plastic and reconstructive surgeon, former president of the Midwestern Association of Plastic Surgeons. We're discussing the surge of patients in his specialty in these times and the nature of the work. Have you had plastic surgery recently? Do you know someone who has? What were some of the decisions you made and how did it affect your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Afifi, what role has telemedicine had in cosmetic surgery and in your specialty?
Yes, another thing that has totally changed in the last year is telemedicine. So now we can see patients online, either for their first visit or for even visits after surgery. I'm sure it has been the same for you, Kate, at your show and having guests. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a totally different dynamics.
Yeah, it really is.
And now many patients, we see them online for the first visit, especially if patients live a few hours away. They don't have to travel. They can see us online. And one of the good things about seeing them online is I'm not wearing a mask. They're not wearing a mask. So you can actually have more of a normal human-to-human interaction without wearing masks, and post-operative visits after the surgery. So now patients, again, continuing recovering from home, we can just log in, we can take a look at the wound, make sure they're doing well. And this has totally changed the field, because now patients can have an online visit with a surgeon next door in Wisconsin or someone in Australia or someone in Texas. So it's opened many options for patients.
So for instance, too, if a patient travels to Florida or another state and is living part of the year somewhere else, that they can still do those follow-up visits.
Correct. And I've had many patients who were my patients here in Wisconsin, then they moved somewhere else, and then they're coming back for their surgery with me. So we can see them online and prepare them for the surgery and answer any questions that they have.
I'm wondering, you know, a cosmetic plastic surgery, it starts with a consultation and, you know, the patient says, doctor, am I a good candidate for this procedure? And you discuss risks, of course. Do you find that there have been new advancements and new technologies that enable you to do surgeries that weren't possible even a decade ago?
Absolutely. And I used to hear this from my mentors when I was in training many years ago, that they would say that the procedures they're performing then are very different than what they learned during their training and medical school and residency. And it's the same here. Plastic surgery is advancing at a very, very fast rate. Many of the procedures I'm doing now are very different from what I was doing 10 years ago. In every single aspect that we do, in cosmetic surgery, in breast reconstruction, the technology in lasers, the different fillers that we have, and even our techniques for recovery and what medications we're giving for patients, for pain control, for recovery, everything is advancing very fast.
Yeah, you bring up so many points that I want to dig into. What has the effect been with lasers? What can you do with laser surgery?
Many things. So lasers alone, they're very helpful for many patients with a multitude of skin conditions, whether it's some pigment, whether it's fine lines. And our numbers show that, again, laser skin resurfacing by plastic surgeons around 1 million are done every single year in the US, and that's just one type of laser resurfacing. Another common one is what's called IPL for brown spots. Again, that's around 830,000 that are done every year by plastic surgeons. So it depends on what the patient's looking for, and we have many different options.
You talk about fillers, and it just reminds me of the silicone gel breast implant global settlement that brought Dow to its knees in the 90s. I remember that very well. What have you seen by way of the change in what is injected and what fill is used in people?
Correct. So most of the fillers that we use today, and for your listeners, that's a very common procedure. Again, our statistics show that by plastic surgeons, 3.5 million were done in 2019. The fillers that we have today are much safer. Most of them are reversible. Most of them can be removed if we have any issues or the patients are not happy. However, even although it's 3-4 million done every single year, it's still something that you have to take your due diligence before doing them. So you have to choose your surgeon or your provider carefully and make sure that you understand what the risks are, what your options are, and what your expectations are, because that's the only way to get a happy and safe result.
We're discussing the rise in plastic and reconstructive surgery in these times with UW Health Surgeon Ahmed Afifi. Have you wondered if you're a good candidate for a procedure? Have you had nasal surgery, functional nasal surgery, to address migraine headache pain? We'll talk more about that. What was the outcome of your plastic surgery? How long did it take to recover? Join in 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. We'll pick this up with Dr. Afifi in a minute here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for a conversation about plastic and reconstructive surgery on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, the highest number of cosmetic surgeries in 2020 were nose reshaping, eyelid surgery, and facelifts. In reconstructive surgery, in that area, the top were tumor removal, laceration repair, and scar revision. Did you have any of these procedures? What do you want to ask the surgeon? It's 800-642-1234. We have plastic and reconstructive surgeon Ahmed Afifi, who's with us for about 5 more minutes. Dr. Afifi, you know, I'm wondering, there is a psychological component to your profession in that you have to help your patients set reasonable expectations for the outcome, for how this procedure will make them look, how it will make them feel. How do you do that? How do you set those expectations?
That's a great question. And it's something that we all plastic surgeons are trying to be better at. Better at knowing what the patient's expectations and goals are and setting the right realistic mutual goals for both of us. I think if patients are unhappy, usually that's where the breakdown was, that the surgeon and the patient did not have the same expectation, the same goals. So this, there is no math to it. This is just an experience. We sit with patients, we discuss with them, what are you expecting out of this procedure? What are your goals? So we know that expression follows emotion. The people who are sad tend to frown more, and people who frown more tend to be sad. And the other thing is this, the opposite is also true. People who tend to smile more are happier, and if they're happier, they smile more. And that is also contagious. So when someone who's smiling walks into a room, people around him start to smile more and start to feel happier. So know that plastic surgery, it changes many aspects of the patient's life. Multiple studies in all types of plastic surgery from all continents show that plastic surgery improves the patient's quality of life. It improves their self-confidence. It improves the first impression that they get. So it has very positive impacts on their quality of life, as long as we both have realistic expectations.
Dr. Afifi, how do you think social media and what people see on social media affects cosmetic surgery?
So this has impacted us in positive ways and maybe not so positive ways. in positive ways because, number one, people are seeing themselves on social media. So there's no doubt about it. People are having their pictures on Instagram and on Facebook all the time, and they want to look good in these pictures. They want to look happy in these pictures. They want to look as good as they feel in these pictures. So yes, it does encourage more people to have plastic surgery. The other thing is patient education. So today, many more patients are open about having plastic surgery. It isn't as secretive as it used to be before. Many of my patients now, they come to me because they know that their friends and their family have had plastic surgery with me, and they're so open about it. At the same time, it does sometimes put unnecessary pressure on patients to have plastic surgery. And that's where what you just mentioned a second ago is just having the consultation with the patient and the discussion with them to make sure that we have realistic expectations of what the plastic surgery can do for you.
Yeah, that you're on the same page. I want to talk about one procedure before we have to go, and it's migraine headaches. What can you tell us about functional nasal surgery and whether this can help relieve chronic headaches?
So surgery for headaches is probably one of the most exciting advances in plastic surgery in the last 20 years. Briefly, this was discovered by total chance. That people were having plastic surgery and they found that their headaches improved. Like, we plastic surgeons, we never thought we'd be treating headaches. And then we started researching it, and we found that during the plastic surgery, we were somehow taking pressure off certain nerves or certain structures around the head, and these could be triggering headaches. Now, this was 25 years ago. Right now, we have a society, the Migraine Surgery Society. We have a ton of research showing the different nerves and the different structures that we can work on around the head that could be contributing or triggering or making their migraines or their headaches worse. Some of these structures are inside the nose, which is the functional rhinoplasty, the functional nose surgery. And some of these structures are around the neck or the eyebrow. So again, not all patients are candidate, not every headache patient is a candidate, but this can have a very positive impact in the right patient.
Dr. Afifi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate. This was fun.
Dr. Ahmed Afifi is an associate professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health.
University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire senior Jenna Luganville is an intern in the campus's Study Abroad office. She manned one of dozens of tables at the school's first Study Abroad fair in more than a year. Luganville spent the fall of 2019 at England's Winchester University and says it was the best time of her life. That makes her excited for all of the students learning about their own options for study abroad.
I mean, it feels good to see that students are finally actually being able to go and having programs not be canceled, you know, almost instantly once students are accepted.
In March 2020, study abroad programs were halted at UW-Eau Claire and other campuses across the U.S., but things are slowly getting back to normal. In July, three students from UW-Eau Claire traveled with faculty to Central Europe for a three-week immersion trip to Germany, the Czech Republic, and Austria. Jeff DeGrave works in the Study Abroad office and helped organize the trip, where students learned about culture, politics, and conflicts in the region.
And within 2 weeks of us returning, the numbers had gone up, and the European Union said they would not allow non-essential travelers to Europe from the United States till further notice. So it was a window in time.
UW-Eau Claire senior Anna Green is hoping for a second chance at studying abroad before graduating next year. In March 2020, she was 3 weeks into a semester abroad in Chile when she was recalled. Now Green is scheduled to spend 2 weeks in Guatemala next spring. COVID-19 infections are now high in the Central American nation, but she prefers to be on the optimistic side and says students should go for it.
This might be your chance. You just might be able to go and have that experience you've been dreaming of. And if you just don't at least try and go for it, well, then you're not ever gonna have that possibility and that opportunity.
National surveys suggest last year's cancellations led to more than $1 billion in lost revenues for schools running study abroad programs. While programs are restarting, the COVID-19 pandemic has added a long list of hurdles to an already complex process. Melissa Torres is the president of the national nonprofit Forum on Education Abroad. She says U.S. State Department travel advisories are taking the local status of the pandemic into account and that can change quickly.
So when you're a university trying to plan 6, 12, or 18 months out and enrolling students and having them choose their courses and lining up faculty to run some of these programs or working with overseas partners, it's really problematic.
Tori says colleges are now using additional sources like the World Health Organization or reports from university partners abroad. She says larger colleges are likely having an easier time with it than smaller schools with less staff. Scott Pearson heads the Office of International Education at UW-Stout. He says there are usually more than 200 students abroad in a typical year. Pearson says 4 students are overseas this semester.
That was a breakthrough, a milestone for us to say, like, well, we're finally back at it. We finally have students exploring and enjoying the world again.
During a walk to the grocery store in the Belgian city of Kortrijk, UW-Stout senior Melissa Neumeier used her phone to record sounds from the neighborhood she's living in while spending a semester at Howest University. Neumeier says she was nervous about leaving home and calls mailing visa paperwork and notarized COVID-19 test results a debacle. But after a week of campus orientation and meeting fellow international students, she says it was all worth it.
Even before my classes, I've definitely opened my eyes and I've become more confident in myself, and just being able to be in a different country and further my skill set.
Schools are hopeful more students will be able to gain that kind of confidence again soon. A recent survey of universities found a majority expect to reach pre-pandemic levels of study abroad participation next year. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And just ahead, we speak with 2 archaeologists about how climate instability played a part in bringing down some of the world's greatest ancient civilizations. We get a tour through time and space. What questions do you have about how ancient societies crumbled? What role do you think that climate change played in their downfall? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.